Welcome to Let's Talk ETFs. I'm your host, Jonathan Liss, and I've been closely tracking the ETF space for more than 13 years through a variety of roles here at SeekingAlpha.com. Each week, a different guest and I will take an in-depth look at a particular aspect of the rapidly evolving exchange-traded fund space, with a focus on how investors can best utilize ETFs to reach their investing goals. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Nothing said here should be taken as investment advice. All opinions expressed on this show are those of the individuals expressing them alone. A full set of disclosures will be included at the end of this show. You can subscribe to Let's Talk ETFs on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. For reference purposes, this podcast is being recorded on the morning of Monday, October 28th, 2019. My guest today is Janet Flanders Johnston. Janet is a portfolio manager at TrimTab's Asset Management, responsible for the day-to-day management of the firm's two exchange-traded funds, the U.S. All-Cap Free Cash Flow ETF, ticker symbol TTAC, and the International All-Cap Free Cash Flow ETF, ticker symbol TTAI. Prior to joining TrimTab's, Janet managed her family's premier timber and hunting business. Before that, she was an ETF advisor at Madrona Partners. Janet holds a Bachelor of Science in Agricultural Economics from the University of Georgia and is a CFA charter holder. She has been featured on Bloomberg TV and radio, in the Wall Street Journal, CNBC, and as of now, SeekingAlpha.com. Welcome to the show, Janet. It's a thrill to have you here.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, great. So before we get into the TrimTab's philosophy and how that plays out, practically speaking, in the ETFs that you manage, I'm curious as to how you got to where you are today. So you studied agricultural economics in college. You went on to get a CFA. Were you always interested in investing, or did that kind of come later on?
No, my family had a large farming operation in South Georgia, and I always thought that I would graduate from college and go back and work for our family farm. But I had a couple of professors in the agricultural economics department that literally changed my life. Dr. Williams introduced me to commodity markets. And I had this idea that if I could learn about trading and investing, one day I could work from anywhere with a personal computer. And when I was in college, I really wanted to live in Chicago and trade commodities, but I couldn't get a job there. I ended up working on a bond trading desk in Birmingham, Alabama. And in 1988, I answered every one ad in the newspaper and got a job at Salomon Brothers in New York. And shortly after that, I went to work for a firm called Avatar Associates. And that is where I really started learning about how to analyze a company, what variables really impact markets and companies. That firm was owned by Marty Zweig. And my boss at the time and my mentor is our current CIO today. This is the third time I've worked for him.
And who is that?
His name is Ted Theodore. And so I started at Avatar as a technology analyst. And then in the early 90s, I married someone from Seattle and ended up in Seattle. And I worked in institutional sales. And then I worked for a, you know, private partnership that was mostly family money. And I pick stocks and manage portfolios. And then in 2010, I moved back to be an equity strategist with Ted Theodore once again.
I'd love to move over to the TrimTab's approach to investing because I think it's pretty unique. And so the name of the firm, I actually have, you know, heard of TrimTab's many years ago, of course, but had no idea that it was taken from the work of someone named Buckminster Fuller. So who was Buckminster Fuller, and how does his work inform the guiding philosophy and principles behind TrimTab's approach to stock selection?
So I believe he was a scientist, and his work had to do with flaps on a rudder in boats or the flaps on a plane. And for us, that means small changes lead to big results. And with our implementation, we think that means using free cash flow instead of corporate earnings.
Sure. And why is it that TrimTabs is so focused on the use of free cash flow as kind of the primary identifier of underlying value in a particular stock?
Well, what we know is that there's quite a bit of discretion that goes into corporate earnings reports, whether it's the timing, revenues, expenses, or do you capitalize or expense, the valuing of intangible assets. And so we believe that free cash flow is harder to manipulate and that it gives us a reality check on the corporate earnings report.
Sure. Yes. So kind of cutting out some of the potential accounting shenanigans that can happen when you look at earnings as opposed to free cash flow. I know that part of the TrimTabs approach also involves looking at balance sheet health as well as reduced share count. So just curious where these two parts of the equation come from also.
So one of the main things we're trying to do at TrimTabs Asset Management is that we believe high quality companies outperform over the long term. So we start with free cash flow, which is an indication of organic growth. And then we look at balance sheets, how leveraged is a company relative to other companies, and is their leverage improving or is it getting worse? What's the trend? And then we also look at actual share reduction. You know, buyback announcements can generate a lot of press, but the reality is corporations, they have corporate actions, they issue stock to employees. So we look at actual share reduction because we want a bigger piece of the investment pie. And at TrimTabs, we've done a lot of research, and what we've learned is that they're good buybacks versus bad buybacks. So if companies have free cash flow and they're buying back stock, they tend to outperform those that don't have free cash flow. If companies, there are many reasons a company could leverage up its balance sheet, but if we look at a company and they're reducing their share count and their balance sheet is improving or staying the same, that's an indication that that company has organic growth and that they're buying back stock for the right reasons. They're not just buying back stock to leverage up to generate earnings per share growth, to engineer earnings. So we're looking for companies with strong organic growth.
Yeah, sure. No, that makes sense. And so I think I kind of see where you're going with this, but in terms of your multi-factor model, where you're filtering through thousands of stocks and determining what to put into your funds, how does the active management overlay that you're applying, how does that lead to better results?
What we do is we combine seasoned, disciplined, active management in a modern and efficient manner with our multi-factor model. So we start with our model. Free cash flow is the strongest factor in our model. And we like to say the computers do the heavy lifting. And once they have ranked the stocks on all of these different variables, and then they've created composite scores, we also generate lots of supplemental data. And at that point, we usually have clusters of stocks with similar scores. And so as active managers, we choose, you know, which stocks are going in the portfolio and which stocks are being sold. The highest ranked stocks are candidates to buy, and the worst ranked stocks are candidates to sell. Our model does not have a sector filter. We find that correlation is more important for sectors than this type of a factor model. We're also able to look at things that our model cannot anticipate. This year, we've been looking at trade war issues. We're also able to look at other high-quality moats. We like companies with disruptive technology. We like companies with global brands. We like companies with recurring revenues. Those types of things can be a tiebreaker in terms of deciding which company we're going to buy or sell.
Yeah, sure. And I guess the weightings within the portfolios, are you making those decisions also, or is that being largely informed by the heavy lifting being done by the computers?
Our research indicates that over the long term, equally weighted portfolios outperform cap-weighted portfolios. So at the time of implementation, for instance, TTAC, we usually have around 100 stocks. Right now, I think we have about 96. At the time of implementation, we will buy a 1% position. And we don't trade every stock every month because we're not rebalancing back to an index. We have a benchmark we're trying to beat. And we just think that's unnecessary trading. But all companies start out at the same way. And then as they become relatively expensive or extended, we might trim a company back and pair it with a loss when we step in to buy a new name.
Okay, gotcha. So the fact that, let's say, something like Apple is close to 1.5% of TTAC at this point would be a result of the fact that it's run up 50% or whatever relative to the other components in the portfolio. That's not an active decision to weight it higher. It's a result of performance after it's already entered the portfolio, correct?
Absolutely. And then another thing I wanted to mention in terms of, there's been all this hype about smart beta, which hasn't been a cure-all. And
yeah.
What we're finding is that, the economy is changing. Companies are complex. They're getting harder to compare to each other. They have more services. They have more recurring revenues. They have global businesses. And we think it's hard to evaluate a company on a single factor or a Cal 5 accounting measure, such as price to book. We just believe that there's value to our active process and there's value to the multi-factor process.
Yeah, sure. I was going to say value in particular, which, is at this point famously, is in one of its worst periods of underperformance relative to growth since these things have started being measured. The over-reliance on all of that data was produced that went into those initial three-factor models, what are now generally five-factor models, was based on things like price to book. And, we're not really in a very capital intensive kind of economy at this point. And it's very difficult to know how you value things like intellectual property, like that cutting edge technology, like you're saying, relative to those physical assets. So yeah, it's possible that, things will swing back and traditional value will become a leader again, but it's possible that those traditional metrics for at least factors like value have just kind of, their time has passed to some extent, at least theoretically. So it definitely, understand that the case for getting a set of human eyes and human thinking around how to weight things and select them also.
A great example, if you look at the Russell 3000, our research indicates that only 5% of the companies fall within 5% of their book value, which tells you there's a lot of discretion in accounting practices. And to some extent, with value, I think beauty is in the eye of the beholder. You really can't rely on calcified accounting measures.
Yeah, no, that's good. I think that's a good pull quote right there. Okay, so I'd love to move over to the two funds that you manage specifically. The first is the TrimTabs All Cap US Free Cash Flow ETF, ticker symbol TTAC. It's gathered assets at a fairly nice clip. I think it's over $120 million in AUM at this part. And it has definitely exhibited strong long-term performance. So basically the only kinds of all cap category ETFs that have outperformed it, let's say over the last 3 years, were a few things in the kind of momentum and low vol categories. But broadly speaking, it's been a very strong performer. So just to give listeners a window into your process here, I'd love to do a bit of a deep dive into what is currently the fund's top holding. And again, we've clarified that that's run up on its own, Zoetis Inc. Could you give us like a 90-second version of why this stock made it into the portfolio and why you haven't trimmed the holding at the holding size at this point?
Well, we have trimmed it many times, and okay. It's probably due to be trimmed again. It's been a strong performer for a long time. One of the things we like about Zoetis is that it is the number one market share leader in animal pharmaceuticals. Now, that's companion animals, but it's also livestock and poultry production, and also for horses. And this healthcare has been a minefield this year. That with all of the, it's hard to tell what the healthcare model in the U.S. is going to be in the future. There's a lot of pricing pressure that pharmaceutical companies have in the U.S. today. But in the animal healthcare space, you know, obviously they're regulated by the FDA, but they're not regulated in terms of pricing. And they're also a play on emerging markets as China and India and some of these rising emerging economies add more meat to their diets.
Yeah, sure.
So it's just been a real steady eddy. It's got a strong market position. There are not that many companies in the animal healthcare pharmaceutical space.
That makes sense. And I was actually, when I was looking at it, because I, you know, have not encountered this stock all that much, which is probably why I somewhat butchered the name there. It's got a $60 billion market cap, which was really kind of surprising to me, because it's not kind of one of these names that you hear, you know, bandied about regularly. You've got much smaller companies like Tesla that basically, you know, fill tons of noise and space in the financial media. So pretty interesting story there.
Yeah, they were a spin out from Pfizer.
Okay.
A few years ago. And, you know, they have also benefited from the rising expenditures for companion animals. We love our pets, and many people are willing to do whatever it takes for their pets to live longer. So we like all of the tailwinds that this company has.
Yeah, sure. And so one reason that ETFs have been touted so much and there's been so many assets that have moved into them is because of how tax efficient they generally are. And I'm just curious how much turnover you normally see in TTAC and also in your other fund, TTAI. Is this generally as tax efficient as kind of a comparable index fund? How are you tax managing? Are you making decisions about whether to buy or sell or trim positions based on potential tax implications? Just curious how you guys go about that.
We are not a high turnover strategy. Our turnover is about 70%. Mm-hmm. If you think of our products as a mutual fund and an ETF wrapper, we have, you know, if we distribute a capital gain, then that is taxed. But one of the benefits of being active is that we're very tax aware. We have not distributed a capital gain in 5 years. And we will not be distributing one this year. And recently, there's a new SEC rules where there's a trading process that we will be able to do, but it's going to make it easier for us to not deliver capital gains. And there is going to be an advantage to active funds and an ETF wrapper versus the traditional mutual fund wrapper. So our product will be more like how the index funds are taxed. You're not taxed until you sell it.
Sure. And are you not worried about people front running your stock picks at all?
You know, we actually believe that full disclosure is in the best interest of the client. And we also like the fact that our fund trades all day and that there's liquidity. What we think is that someone might try to front run the fund, but invariably of the 100 names, someone is going to have a specific opinion about a stock or two, and that they'll drift away from what we do at some point. So we just aren't that concerned. We think a fully transparent model is the best one for the investor.
Yeah, sure. No, agreed. I mean, that's definitely one of the big disadvantages of the mutual fund wrapper, that you know, the investor essentially has no idea in real time what's in the fund. So by the time they find out, you know, it's months have passed. And while that generally is probably not that big a deal, during periods of really large price swings or disconnects like in 2008, 2009, probably would have been nice for people to know, for example, that their fund was loaded up on financials or you know, different kinds of real estate exposure in that period. And you know, people may not have been aware just how exposed they were in many of those kind of high-flying value funds in 2007 and 2008. So yeah, point taken there. Okay, so I'd love to take this beyond just kind of academic discussion here. Look at a company that's one of the best performing stocks of the last decade, up more than 3,300%, which is Netflix, ticker symbol NFLX. First of all, I notice it's not in TTAC. It has never produced free cash flow in its history and is expected to actually produce negative free cash flow of roughly $3.5 billion in 2019 as the streaming wars heat up and, you know, there's a lot of pressure on them to spend a ton of money on really new and original content to be able to compete against Disney and Hulu and all the other players in the game, new and old. So is this just kind of a case of herd mentality and investors piling into an overbought name, the momentum play, sort of, so to speak? Or is there another explanation here that dovetails with what you do at TrimTaps? Or I guess to put it differently, are there other reasons to like Netflix? Or for those with free capital and patience, is this kind of the perfect short opportunity right now?
So I think with Netflix, I give them credit. They created the streaming market. They've had award-winning content, and they've had strong subscriber growth. If you look at where they are today, they're sitting in the middle of Amazon and Disney, and both companies have very diversified sources of revenue. They're well-capitalized. And they're in a tough position. They have to spend more money to compete. And to some extent, they're a one-trick pony. And if you look at Netflix, this year they're going to have 46% earnings growth, yet negative $3.4 billion in free cash flow. And in the past, when companies have been at this type of juncture, it hasn't been sustainable. And I'm really dating myself and going down this road, but if you look way back to the days of, say, WorldCom or Enron, where they had earnings growth, but negative free cash flow growth, eventually that came back to roost. Like, you know, they ended up being two of the most famous bankruptcies in the history of the U.S. stock market. So I think that Netflix is in a very tough position. I would not want to be an owner here. It's hard to call the top, but I think we're seeing more and more cracks to the story.
Yeah, no, I think that's well put. And I guess, you know, there's always the possibility that they could end up with some kind of an Amazon style pivot. And, you know, I don't think anybody saw Amazon's dominance in the cloud space coming when they were just losing money hand over fist in the retail space. But, you know, short of something like that, it does seem hard to understand how they can maintain their current valuations going forward with just how competitive that landscape is becoming.
And I heard something yesterday that really stuck out to me. For instance, Disney has a lot of licensing revenues. And at Netflix, all of these millennials, which have made Netflix, are now getting married and having kids. And Netflix doesn't have the content for the families. It's mostly for adults. So it'll be really interesting to see how loyal when Disney Plus comes out. But we think Disney Plus is going to be a fantastic product.
Yeah, sure. And I guess we don't have to wait that long at this point, right? It's coming out in November, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, of course, there is the possibility that particularly for millennials and younger generations, people that have basically just been cord cutting at unprecedented levels, that, you know, if the monthly price of a full cable package is $80 or $100 a month, they may end up subscribing to five or six streaming services that cost around $10 a month. They're still saving a significant amount there. But I still think the point is well taken. And, you know, it's hard to see how there won't be margin compression there and at least some fall off in subscribers as you say, as people have families and they look to diversify the kinds of content that they have in their home. So I think it's a well put argument there. So I'd love to move over to TTAI here, which is your international all cap free cash flow ETF. This fund is newer, and so it's got less of a track record and of course, less assets as a result of that. First of all, it's the same exact methodology, just applied to ex-US companies. Is it developed specifically or is it the entire globe?
It's developed. Our benchmark is the S&P ex-US Developed Markets Index, and that is basically IFA plus Canada. The portfolio is managed the same way as our domestic portfolio, TTAC.
Sure. So you've got that overlay, the factor model with the computers doing the heavy lifting, and then you're putting that human touch on top of it, making those final buy and sell and trim position or add to position type decisions there.
That's correct.
Okay, great. And so I'm curious about the top holding, which is actually an exchange-traded fund, the iShares MSCI South Korea Capped ETF, ticker symbol EWY. Just curious why hold an ETF with its accompanying expense ratio as opposed to just, you know, some of the top holdings within that fund in the portfolio. Is this something to do with South Korea as a country being some sort of free cash flow powerhouse, or is there something else at play here, such as the cost of ownership of stocks listed domestically in Seoul?
Well, Korea is a country, a developed country that we want to be invested in. They're a leader in technology. They're very innovative country. They do have companies with strong free cash flow, but operationally, it's really expensive to buy local companies in Korea. We do own Samsung, which we buy in London as a GDR, and it trades in US dollars. But other than that, it's very hard to get exposure. And so as active managers, we're able to make the decision that it's in the best interest of our investors that we buy EWY as a proxy for Korean exposure.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. It's an interesting approach. And, you know, I guess you guys have crunched the numbers and see that it actually saves investors money while getting them the exposure you want by holding that as opposed to having to go out and buy 10 or 15 of those names that are in that portfolio.
Absolutely.
Okay, so without going down the Brexit rabbit hole too far here, I think it bears at least a brief mention when discussing an international fund that has European exposure. How are you approaching UK domiciled equities in light of the continued uncertainty swirling around Brexit?
Well, one of the ways we have approached Brexit, but also some of these countries, generally speaking, because last fall and the fourth quarter, the global economy was slowing ahead of the U.S. economy. And because many of these countries were trade is a bigger percentage of GDP than it is in the U.S. And these developed markets were clearly in a bear market in the fourth quarter. And one of the things that we leaned into with our high quality philosophy, looking at the free cash flow and looking at the balance sheet, but also looking at global brands. Like, we think that companies with strong global brands, it's a way to escape their borders. And so while we own UK companies and companies listed in the UK, many of them have these global brands, so they're not tied so much to the UK economy.
Yeah, sure. No, that makes sense. So you are, again, as you, I think, pointed out earlier, you're looking at things like the uncertainty around Brexit, like the U.S.-China trade war and things of that nature when evaluating each of the companies in the portfolio.
And that's correct. And one thing that we have learned, because we look at management discussions and earnings and free cash flow from companies in the U.S., companies in Europe, companies in Asia, few companies in China. And what we've noticed across the globe is that the consumer has been really strong. There's record low unemployment in developed countries as well as in the U.S. The U.S. consumer has been rock solid. The Chinese consumer, the emerging middle-class Chinese consumer, continues to buy global brands at a record pace. And so one of the things that we've noticed is we have companies in both portfolios that have strong growth in the U.S. and double-digit consumer exposure in China.
That is very interesting. And I think leads into the next question nicely, which is that TTAI is having a great year relative to its benchmark, which you mentioned was the S&P developed ex-US total return market. What, in your opinion, is driving its outperformance this year?
I think we have actively looked for companies with many moats and cushions. So free cash flow, global brands, innovative technology. We have some companies that just have North America revenues. We have, for instance, we own the largest convenience store operator in North America. It's a Canadian company. We own Lululemon in both funds. It's a Canadian company. And I think those high quality companies that have done well despite their local economy have really helped this portfolio rise above its peers.
Sure. That's and be interesting to see if that continues onward. Just out of curiosity, for those that are less familiar, what's the difference between the benchmark of TTAI, the S&P Developed X U.S. Total Return Index, and the more popular or followed MSCI EAFE Index? Is it just the exclusion of Canada, or is there some other difference there also?
It has to do with the exclusion of Canada.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And Canada is often left out of global benchmarks and global exposure. So just kind of shows the level of attention to detail you have that you've chosen to track an index that includes Canada as opposed to, or not to track, but to benchmark against, as opposed to, you know, many of these international funds. You have your US, you have your ex-US, and then where's Canada? No exposure whatsoever. So that's, I think, a good indicator there.
Thank you. And there are some fabulous Canadian companies that we want to be able to buy.
Yeah, sure. Definitely. As you mentioned, Lululemon is one of them. I'm sure there's a few others in there also. Okay, so I'd love to move over to the trim tabs approach as a broad macro indicator. And I think it'll bring us to our final segment here. I think it's a nice way to start winding things down. So I'm curious if free cash flow and their overall approach that you take at trim tabs can be used as a predictor on a macroeconomic scale. And if so, what does what you're seeing say about the state of U.S. and global economies and the outlook for markets, broadly speaking, right now?
We don't see a correlation between our process and the macro environment. But our experience and our research tells us that our bottoms-up process works over the long term. So our goal is to hopefully outperform our benchmarks over the long term and to provide a smoother ride, to have some cushions in our portfolio, to have more of an all-weather type approach.
Yeah, sure. No, that makes sense. And then I guess finally, we've seen a multi-year trend, I guess, going back to the mid-90s at this point, towards the number of shares of companies that are listed that are available on the open market has shrunk significantly. And I was just curious, as somebody who looks at share floats, what you make of this trend and whether you think it bodes negatively or is some kind of an ominous sign for stock picking, investing in the longer term.
Well, we think at lower actual share counts are positive for the investor as long as they're not being done purely to engineer growth that isn't there. But on balance, we like companies that are reducing their share count as long as they have free cash flow and their balance sheets in good shape. I think that we see many companies with strong organic growth. I think in this environment where there's been this huge move to passive ETFs, what we find is that they're less stock pickers. And we think that's an advantage. That's an opportunity for us between the bots that are just looking for words in press releases and stocks are overreacting to the passive approaches that don't discriminate against the good versus the bad, the better or the worse companies. As active managers, we think there's an opportunity there.
So what else does TrimTabs have planned on the fund launch front? Anything you can let our listeners know about?
Well, we're working more on the institutional side with separately managed accounts versus new ETFs.
Okay, interesting. Where can investors go to do more research on the topics we discussed?
Well, it's interesting. There's an organization called the CFA Institute, which is highly regarded, but I think many people don't know that you can go to their website and they actually have quite a bit of research. And they did a big report in 2016 called The Misrepresentation of Earnings, which was a survey of 400 CFOs. Mm-hmm. There's quite a bit of research on their website about accounting issues, earnings, issues with corporate earnings reports. So I would encourage listeners, if they want to dive into some meaty reports, that they can go to the CFA Institute website. We have done quite a bit of research on free cash flow and have some white papers on our website. And our website is www.trimtabsfund.com. Mm-hmm.
Sure. Yeah. And I was perusing that earlier. If you go to the research section, there are a bunch of really interesting looking white papers there. So I guess there will be more along these lines, also free cash flow and what it bodes for future performance. But you guys also do stuff on, you know, some of this accounting magicianry that many companies have been using share buybacks for and the like to mask the fact that their earnings are actually falling or is that really more just the CFA website people should go to for that?
We have quite a few pieces on our website, and I think one of the interesting things, if you go to our website, we've done quite a bit of research over the last year on free cash flow. And the thing that is clear to us, whether you're looking at IPOs, the NASDAQ 100, dividends, buybacks, zombie companies, if companies have free cash flow, they tend to outperform those that don't. So we think that's why we think free cash flow is one of the last sources of unwind alpha. And we also have some papers on buybacks on our website, the good versus the bad.
Sure.
And I would encourage anyone that's interested in these topics to take a look at our white papers. And if they want to dig into deeper into the earnings issues and earnings manipulation, they can also go to the CFA Institute website.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. And just for full disclosure, I did want to mention that I personally own TTAC and TTAI. I also own Amazon, and in TTAC, we own Disney, Amazon, Zotus, and we also own Lululemon in both our funds.
And then where can investors find you online? Are you on social media? Are you on Twitter?
I am on Twitter. I am on LinkedIn, and then a lot of the press that I've done is on our website, www.trimtapsfunds.com.
Sure. And what's your Twitter handle?
My handle is at Janet F. Johnston.
All right. Excellent. So listeners can follow you there. Anyway, Janet, this has been fascinating. It's been really interesting. I want to thank you for being so generous with your time today and wish you best of luck out there.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
If you've been enjoying Let's Talk ETFs, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. And if you find this podcast useful, please consider leaving a review on one of those platforms so that other investors can discover it. You can also find this podcast on SeekingAlpha.com by typing Let's Talk ETFs into the search bar at the top of the site.